Good evening and welcome to episode 137 of Inside Learning for Thursday, February the 20th, 2014. It should have been messier. Bill, good evening. It's really good to talk to you. I'm sorry I've just interrupted that important plug of listeners can't see this, but we've got the video on here.
And that important little glug of Vimto.
Vimto, yes. Yeah, Arnbrew.
Good to hear from you again.
Yeah, it's good to have you and on the show again. And Matthew's taking a well-earned evening off. I hope his curry's not too hot tonight.
That's what he's up to, is it?
Yeah, I believe so. He's having a well-earned break with Julie. And so it's you and me putting Joyce to sleep tonight.
Uh-huh. Our listener.
Yes, our listener.
Hi, Joyce.
I'm interested here, Bill. Presumably, if you win the yes vote in the referendum, then the curling team becomes Scottish, presumably. and halves our medal count, the GB medal count in one go.
Listen, whatever happens in the referendum, we're quite happy for the colours to be Scottish and British, which is what they are, and what they will remain, regardless. Everybody wins,
yeah. Well, the curling's been the only bright spot on the sporting horizon for me this week, so I won't, I'll hastily...
Ah, Champions League and all that.
Oh, yeah.
I wasn't going to mention that.
I'll hastily skate over that before we get onto thin ice.
We're missing Matthew for the pun.
Yes.
He's probably providing them if he's listening. Somewhere.
Yeah, we'd be deluged in bad puns by now. I know
the show will be a skeleton of its usual,
yes.
Of its usual form.
Well, we've got some good things in the pipeline, so
of course. It's downhill.
Right, well, we'll jump off then into a podcast. We're going to do a couple of new quick news items tonight, and then we wanted to pick up on the real David Cameron's guest spot last night and something he talked about, or we talked about around assessment. So we'll come back to that later in the podcast. Do you want to kick us off with a quick news story then, Bill?
Yeah, this is a story actually. It's a week old now, but I think it's still worth mentioning. I'm not quite sure whether to laugh or cry at this story. It's a story about this head teacher, Steve Fairclough, head teacher of Abbots Home School in Staffordshire, a private school, and he told a conference last week apparently that heads should instill a culture of fear in their schools through the introduction of performance-related pay. And that was really the only effective way of, as he put it, weeding out bad teachers. He said it should not be about exam results, but based more on behaviour than results. So I'm guessing that that's going to be a purely subjective sort of judgment on his part. In other words, if you don't meet his criteria for success, then you go. A bit like football management, maybe, I don't know.
Yes.
Anyway, he says, fear is good. Make them fear failure. Make them so scared if they don't perform or if they don't behave in a way you want them to, you'll ask them to leave. Seems like a thoroughly bad philosophy to me, but hey-ho, he said... To stop bad teachers, or almost all bad teachers, ruining the lives of children is my mission, my passion. And this is a head teacher who was praised, incidentally, by Ofsted, by inspectors for the school was praised for its inspiring leadership, which I assume included his leadership since he is a head teacher. So, interesting.
Excellent. Sounds really Victorian, doesn't it?
Exactly.
It's a grad grind and the stick. I mean, what's also interesting is because the NUT commissioned quite a bit of research into performance-related pay because it's obviously on the horizon in England, and they found that there's absolutely no evidence that performance-related pay in the public sector, while it might have some benefits in some private sector organisations, there's actually no evidence that it works in the public sector, and mainly because people are driven by different values.
Yeah,
and in fact may have a dampening effect. Personally, I don't see, you know, because fear, too much fear shuts you down, doesn't it, at the end of the day?
Of course it does. I mean, you don't need to be a psychiatrist or a psychologist to realise that fear inhibits people's behaviours and actions. But, I mean, if apart from anything else, you know, when you try to apply that to a very complex educational model, I mean, what is performance? And it invariably comes down to exam results. So you're judging teachers on kids' exam results.
Yeah.
So what I would say in that situation is, give me the kids who are going to get the best exam results. Thank you very much.
Yeah. And we'll put the ones who don't toe the line outside in the car, or you can have them.
Somebody else's class.
Yes. send them to the head teacher. You can put the fear of God into them.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's a kind of bit of a, probably a bit of a sad reflection on where we are, given that our Secretary of State in England is all for deregulating the teaching force, and presumably what goes in the private sector he'd love to import into the state sector as well. But I think one of the signs is in England that the unions are becoming much more united on this, on these issues. And I think they're becoming less narrowly engaged in the terms and conditions, and more widely engaged in the curriculum argument, which I think is good.
I suppose they would be inevitably. Let's face it. I mean, most if not all teachers become teachers because they want to be involved in developing young people to the best of their abilities. I'm sure the money aspect of it is not a huge consideration. I mean, if money was the first consideration, you would go and do something else.
Yeah. Well, so I found an interesting story, which is kind of, I suppose, a reflection on where we are. But it was about a report commissioned by the European Youth Forum and the International Institution for Democracy and Electoral Assistance. and it was looking at the kind of the low levels of voting from 18 to 13 year olds in the European elections. Apparently the UK voted less than any other, young people in the UK voted less than any other European country. I think it was only 18% voted in the last EU election, compared to 58.9% in Sweden. And the report basically says that actually young people are feeling excluded from politics and the political debate, you know, so they don't trust political parties. They don't feel that political parties are talking to them. But I think there's a wider issue here, which is to do with schooling. And I think it's, you know, because the micro relationships in school are not particularly democratically inviting for young people. A lot of the young people I've talked to are interested in political issues, and they are interested in civic issues, but they feel that the way that they're kind of their schools are exam factories, they're not kind of particularly developing them as citizens.
It's interesting you should say that, Steve. I mean, that's obviously particularly apt in Scotland at the moment, in the run-up to the referendum in September, and with 16 to 18-year-olds able to vote for the first time, crucially. Massively important decision for these young people to make, and they need to be informed to make it. Now, my anecdotal evidence would suggest from Twitter and other places and teachers I know that there are many teachers out there of social subjects and other subjects who are engaging young people in that discussion as far as they are able to. There are worrying signs in some place. I mean, on Twitter today, for instance, worrying signs that there are, let's say, there are certain campaign websites on one side of the referendum debate, apparently being blocked by local authorities, or let's say they're having technical issues in accessing the Yes campaign website, to be precise. Now, I would hope that there are technical issues. If these sites were being blocked, I would be concerned for. I'd be concerned for democracy, actually, because young people are. I mean, we've had bits of debates about whether 16-year-olds should have a vote, whether they're capable of making decisions. Of course they are. I mean, for me, there's no question. I mean, if you can legally be married at 16, you can join the armed forces at 16, you can vote in democratic elections, for goodness sake, and should be.
Yeah.
So it does raise a whole load of other issues, and we'll possibly come back to the issue of the four capacities of Curriculum for Excellence tonight, one of which is to develop responsible citizens. And one of the aspects of developing responsible citizens, I'm looking at the graph here, so I don't need to do this from memory, but one of the aspects of a responsible citizen is to develop knowledge and understanding of the world and Scotland's place in it. Mm. That's a direct quote. So if you want to develop that capacity in young people, then they need to have access to information and they need to be having the debate.
Yes.
On the other hand, I know there are schools, a few schools up and down the country, which have had the debate. Prestwick Academy, for instance, which is my old school, along the road here, did have a referendum debate about a month ago, and there were around 200 youngsters at it, and it was organised by the youngsters, and it was the young people who asked all the questions.
Yeah.
So they do want to be involved and engaged in that kind of. If they see a purpose to it, and I think your European message is that if they can't see how it directly impinges on their lives, then obviously they're not going to be involved.
No, and I think the European politicians have made very little effort to reach out and do that. I mean, what was interesting, when I was in Birmingham, we had a project in Birmingham called the Young People's Parliament, and when the G8 came over, back in, oh gosh, I can't remember when it was now, must have been.
Is this Glen Eagles one?
No, to Birmingham. Yeah. Clinton came and Blair was there, must have been around 2000, but anyway, and Yeltsin came and they met representatives from the Youth Parliament in Birmingham and were highly impressed by the level of, and this was a kind of, the young people put messages to them, put questions to them. But these questions are being debated through a series of parliaments, through a series of meetings within schools, and generated a huge interest in the political process. And I think, you know, Clinton and Blair and people were really impressed. I mean, my colleague, a friend, Phil, who ran it, Phil Grierson, who kind of generated the process, he said the Russians were really hacked off because apparently Yeltsin was too drunk to meet them, so sent along some envoy, but the Russians were also engaged in the process, you know. So they met major world leaders, but my memory of that kind of whole young people's parliament is if you bring people in, young people in, and start to talk to them, then of course they get engaged in it, you know. Mm. Whereas if you say, oh well, they're not mature enough, therefore we're going to exclude them, then of course they won't get involved in it, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Simple as.
I mean, we actually have a very successful young people's parliament here in Holyrood in Edinburgh, and but I suppose as with all things, it's a number of committed young people who get involved. And
yeah.
I suppose the issue is how do you get more people involved?
Yeah,
that's the question.
It's always an issue. But that's the issue throughout our society, isn't it? And and unfortunately, I think schools should be doing a lot more, which then I think brings us neatly on, as you said, to the whole issue around Curriculum for Excellence. And you mentioned one of the four capacities about responsible citizens. And the reason why I've come back to this, Bill, is that as you... listeners will know, we had a really kind of interesting conversation with the real David Cameron last week. And Matthew made up
the old pop tart.
Yes, the pod tart. Yes.
Fantastic.
Yeah, excellent. Matthew made this comment along the lines that, you know, we've had to rethink, you know, we've kind of arrived back at the same place. We've almost complicated the assessment again, but not changed the deep philosophy of it. Mm. And he was trying to get David to, you know, David agreed with him that a number of errors have been made in the implementation of Curriculum for Excellence and its kind of alignment with assessment. But
yeah,
you know, Matthew was trying to drill down into what do we need to do now. And I think there's a kind of important learning, not just for Scotland, but I think for all education systems in this debate, because it is about the alignment, isn't it, of the purposes, the pedagogy, the curriculum, and the assessment, you know, how these things, how the narratives are aligned. So I wanted to kind of get your views on that, really.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I suppose in a nutshell, my view would be that many of us were very excited by the arrival of Curriculum for Excellence and the notion that it was about decluttering the curriculum, giving teachers more freedom to pursue a curriculum that suited the young people that they had in front of them rather than a sort of homogenous, standardised thing across the country. And to try to move away from an assessment-led curriculum, if you like, that where assessment qualifications drove everything else. The reality in the intervening years has proved slightly different, and I've been interested just over the last two or three days to have a look at what Mark Priestley of Stirling University has been saying about the whole business. And Mark is a professor of education at Stirling University and is probably one of the foremost spokespersons, if you like, on Curriculum for Excellence here at the moment. A guy who's done a lot of research and investigation of the curriculum. And he wrote a blog post last week, and I'll just give you a little flavour of it. He said, Curriculum for Excellence was widely welcomed on its inception in 2004. Teachers gave a thumbs up to its avowed intention to declutter the curriculum and greatly reduce the spectre of assessment-driven learning. Academics welcomed its openness and apparent return, in brackets, to trusting teachers as professional curriculum developers. Overseas, Curriculum for Excellence was widely seen as a remarkable departure from the sort of technicist prescriptive curriculum that had blighted schools for nigh on two decades. However, he goes on, today we seem to stand in a different place. My daily Twitter feed and media stories speak a very different stories, a different story. Widespread disillusionment, even amongst many of those teachers who have been steadfast supporters of CFE. A widespread view amongst secondary teachers that the introduction of new CFE-ready qualifications has been botched, and many teachers complaining about an increase in bureaucracy associated largely with the demands of assessment. So, you know, fairly critical. He does end the blog post very positively by saying, this is not a knock at Curriculum for Excellence, I'm a big fan. The above discussion might be read as savage criticism of CFE. It should not be. I fundamentally endorse the general direction of the curriculum, even if I am critical of aspects of the implementation model. So he is a fan of Curriculum for Excellence, but he's critical of the way things have developed. And he, along with a colleague of his, Walter Humes, wrote a paper in 2010 called The Development of Scotland's Curriculum for Excellence, Amnesia and Deja Vu, which I thought was quite a good title, in which they cite another educationist, A.V. Kelly, who described, if you like, three models for curriculum development. One was curriculum as content and education as transmission, so a transmission model, if you like. Secondly, curriculum as product and education as instrumental. And the third one was curriculum as process and education as development. So I think what Mark is suggesting in all of that is that Curriculum for Excellence, on its appearance, seemed to be taking us in the direction of curriculum as process, as, if you like, the development of the young person in the round, hence the four capacities and so on. But somewhere along the way, it kind of morphed into something different from that, or regressed, if you like, into something much more akin to an amalgamation of curriculum as a mixture of content and product. And I think what he's suggesting, and I would certainly go along with this if it is what he's suggesting, is that at the point at which the move from the four capacities into the next phase of development was the writing of the outcomes and experiences frameworks. And the outcomes and experiences frameworks were written in 8 separate curriculum areas. And the 8 separate curriculum areas largely reflected the kind of subject areas which, in a sense, which we had always had with slight variations. So I think the point is that as soon as the move was made from the 4 capacities, which were processed, into the outcomes and experiences, we ended up with a huge tension and conflict.
Right. So, as I understand the statements of experiences and outcomes, aren't they? As I understand them, what I've read of them, they're phrased in the kind of first person. So, for example, I have experienced a sort of exciting performance, and so on. And it reminds me very much of what Tim Brighouse did when he became head of education in Birmingham. Was he introduced this entitlement, if you like, a language of entitlement? He said, "Well, you know, we've got to get teachers talking the same language." So there's a sort of we phrased, for example, in the primary curriculum, you know, it was I'm entitled, or I will experience a live performance. I will have experience of a outdoor education program, and so on. But we were never expected to assess those in any terms of any kind of standardised or outwardly audited assessment. This was for the kind of teachers in order to gain a kind of language, but by which they could make relevant judgments about how well they were doing in those experiences in the context of their own schools. So when I read the kind of the statement of experiences and outcomes, I kind of half expected that was the process you might engage in.
Well, interestingly enough, Steve, when the outcomes and experiences were written, which I guess would be 4 or 5 years ago now, thereabouts, in the documentation which accompanied all of this process, at some point there is a statement that these outcomes and experiences are, quote, not designed as assessment criteria in their own right. In other words, I mean, there are 8 curriculum areas, and I'm not sure how many outcomes and experiences in each curriculum area, but I think I read that there are something like 600 odd outcomes and experiences. So there's a significant number of them over 4 levels, 5 levels. They were explicitly not designed as assessment criteria, and that message, I remember that message being put out there on a number of occasions, because it would have been easy for teachers to pick up these grids, because they're in the form of grids, and some people love grids, you know, they just add a column at the end and
where you
tick
it.
But somewhere soon after, in one of the building the what were called the building the curriculum documents, which came out over a couple of years, in a further building the curriculum document, it said, but they should allow for evaluation. So that's that may well be a very subtle difference, but it would be far too subtle for most people. It would be far too subtle for me. I mean, what's the difference between they're not designed as assessment criteria, but they should allow for evaluation? You know, so what was happening, or what has been happening in a lot of cases, is that people have been taking these grids, these statements, at the various levels, and turning them into assessment grids.
Yeah.
So that an outcome which is designed to be met, if you like, over a period of time, suddenly, you may well have a teacher deciding that within the course of a lesson that a young person, you have demonstrated that you've met that outcome within sort of a single lesson and ticking the box, which was entirely not the point of the outcomes and experiences. And I think what was intended was actually for teachers at some point along with the young person to make some kind of holistic judgment about where they were in terms of these outcomes and experiences, not to use them, certainly not on a daily basis, and certainly not as assessment criteria. But that seems to be, I think many people, maybe for want of alternatives, have actually drawn them up as assessment criteria or assessment grids.
So where is the drive to read them in that way come from? I mean, where's the pressure on the system?
I think it may be coming from different directions. It may be coming in some cases from local authority people who are asking schools for grades or results or levels or something. I think it may be coming in some instances from parents even, because some parents are more comfortable with being given a grade or a level for the child. Some, I say, certainly not all by any means. So I think the pressure may be coming from different directions. And I think the difficulty with that is that it takes us right back down the road again of a teacher having to take responsibility for the learning of every young person in their charge. And that's what we've been trying to move away from. The very fact that these outcomes and experiences are written, as you say, in the first person, I can, not my teacher can, I can, suggest to me that the responsibility for the learning is with the learner, and that's exactly where it should be, with support from the teacher.
Right. In terms, because this is a really interesting, if you like, story about a national, albeit in a smaller country in terms of population and numbers of schools, but I think there's a huge amount of learning here. But I'm wondering whether one of the drivers for this, because Matthew seemed to suggest that teachers almost go back to a default position, you know, if there's not sufficient kind of pressure or guidance or development, then the default position might be around, say, transmission. So, you know, we transmit stuff, knowledge or whatever, and therefore if I've transmitted it, I've got to test that I've put it in there successfully. That's almost like a default, whereas your curriculum for excellence is much more holistically, I suppose, I don't know, seems to be, if to theorize it would be what Vygotsky and the constructivist or whatever. Whereas maybe Matthew kind of was wondering whether the default position of a lot of your teachers are much more about, well, transmission, you know, and so it's a different pedagogical model. And the reason I kind of raise that is that I was reading some of Pasi Solberg's work about the Finnish story, where he seems to suggest that in the early years of their transformation, they spend a lot of time on theories of learning. And when I was with a kind of about a group of about 40 young teachers the other week, but I too had about 80 through this on this Teach First course, and I asked them, you know, what are your theories of learning? You know, what do you understand by learning? Do you have a theory of learning? You know, how do children learn? How do they do? And I was actually shocked by how few of them could answer that. And I wondered, as a national story, whether, you know, we ought to be having those conversations in order for these kind of very progressive frameworks and developments to bed in.
I think part of Priestley and Hume's argument is that nationally we didn't have enough of that conversation as to, as you say, theories of learning. So that, in a sense, the curriculum came out of a national debate and a kind of consensus, if you like, which arose about various aspects of the curriculum. Like there was too much in it. You know, people wanted to, the phrase was, declutter it. There was assessment driven. They wanted less of that. They wanted more personalisation and more choice and so on. And there was a consensus view around that, but not based on any sort of pedagogical reasoning, just based on experience and what people were seeing in front of them and how they wanted it to change. And they certainly argue that. So I think the argument was for more of a process-driven approach, or constructivist, as you describe it, approach to the curriculum, rather than the transmission model. But I think Matthew has a point in that people do revert to that transmission model if that's what they know, and by and large that is what they know. they will revert to that if they're unsure, or if there's a certain element of fear, going back to maybe not our extreme head teacher in Staffordshire, but if there's an element of fear that somebody is coming along to ask you, what on earth have you been doing, that people will revert to that because, in a sense, there's, quote, something to show for it. What might have happened had things been different? And David Podtart Cameron last week used the expression which he had used in Twitter, which was, in Scotland we're very good at launching boats and failing to sail in them.
Right.
And to some extent, you could argue that that's what we've done with curriculum flexions, because if we'd had the courage of our convictions, for example, at the point at which the four capacities were agreed on and sort of teased out a bit, for example, we ended up with the four capacities, which everybody knows by now are successful learners, confident individuals, responsible citizens, and effective contributors. I'm sure many people are aware that there's hardly a child or a teacher in Scotland who couldn't recite these four capacities. But there'll be a very small number of teachers and kids, I guess, who will be able to tell you what comes underneath these four capacities on that same page. For example, under effective contributors, what does that actually mean? It's easy to say it, but what do we mean by that? Under effective contributors, we have the attributes of an enterprising attitude, resilience, and self-reliance, with the capability to communicate in different ways and in different settings, to work in partnership and in teams, to take the initiative and lead, to apply critical thinking in new contexts, to create and develop, and to solve problems. Now, I suspect that if you were to give people a test on these four capacities, my guess is that very few people would be able to remember, nor should they, in a sense, what's underneath these four capacities. And I think a different approach, rather than going from there and jumping back into developing outcomes for each of these eight curriculum areas, I don't know that the eight curriculum areas are hugely significant, to be perfectly honest. I mean, that's quite a controversial thing to say. But let's not forget that secondary teachers are trained in a subject or subjects. So, you know, to stand that on its head would have been a huge sort of political decision, because people's jobs would have been on the line. But let's imagine if an alternative route had been taken from that point, and if instead of developing outcomes and experiences related to curriculum areas or subject areas, let's imagine if these statements that I've just made under effective contributors, for example, to apply critical thinking in new contexts, just imagine if that statement had been further teased out, for example, to suggest what the new contexts might be, or to suggest what to apply critical thinking might actually mean in reality. And so, you could argue, to continue to develop a curriculum which was genuinely about process rather than about content or product.
Yeah. So I'm just kind of, something you said there about the effective contributor bit and the responsible citizens and the underline, there's some quite deep sort of critical philosophical thinking underlying that, isn't there?
Absolutely. There's some huge statements in there.
And presumably we've not had that kind of debate. I was thinking back to one of my friends, John Lloyd, that we haven't had on the podcast for a long time, but he used to be an advisor at the Department in England for Citizenship. That's his area of responsibility. But his PhD thesis was on the citizenship curriculum. I mean, he knew Bernard Crick, and he was in at the beginning of the whole citizenship development in England. But his thesis was about, actually, citizenship is in some ways a form of social control, because we've not thought through it properly. You know, we've not thought through it, and it's fully what we mean by really critical participatory democracy. You know, it's, oh yeah, we can go and sort of, yeah, it's great to pick up litter and do things in the community and stuff, but actually there's something more fundamental about the way that we are and act with people here, which he said schools find really difficult to get into because it's a really difficult.
Absolutely. Well, the thing about that is, of course, is as soon as you empower people and give them a greater part in the democratic process, they start to challenge you, and that, you know, they start to challenge the system. Then, so you have to deal with that. Whereas some people may argue that what we have in Scotland is we have a sort of open, creative invitation in the curriculum to go in a different direction or take risks or do this and do that. But in reality, and in practice, we actually don't. We have what you could argue is actually a very conservative, with a small c, system where people don't take risks. And they do conform. You could argue that they conform even more now than they did 30, 40 years ago, which is a kind of...
It's a real paradox, isn't it?
Given, it's a bit of a paradox.
Given the whole thrust of our kind of cultural thrust has been about individual consumption, and maybe it's about to do with consumption in society. Mm. We're no longer participators or, you know, we're just consumers. So maybe there's a kind of deeper cultural shift, which, and it's difficult for schools and teaching to buck trends in that way. But at some point, we've got to get in and about that question.
Mm. I mean, you could argue, and many people do argue, that what we have in Scotland right now is a situation where, I mean, fewer than or less than 5% of our schools are private schools here, so we do have a sort of fairly homogenous sort of state sector, and you could say that you could argue that all of our schools are all right in Scottish terms. They're all right, or to put that another way, they're pretty okay. Now, do we want to have a scenario where all our schools are okay, some are a bit more okay than others, or do we really want to encourage diversity and difference?
Yeah.
Because I suppose as soon as you encourage greater diversity and difference, then it possibly becomes more obvious that some are much better at it than others. I don't know.
Yeah. No, my brain's starting to hurt now, Bill.
we haven't even spoken yet about how the new national qualifications sort of come in on top of all of that, as they just have, and that's causing a bit of upset at the moment as well.
Right, can you just explain that one, particularly for English?
Yeah, what's happened basically is that we've introduced, if you like, this new curriculum, which is on paper is significantly different, if you like, from the old curriculum. So the argument runs along the lines that we need to redo the national qualifications to match up to fit curriculum, for instance, if you like. So the national qualifications, SQA, are charged with developing the new national qualifications, which they go away and they do. They come up with the new national qualification. So we abandon what standard grade has used to be and intermediate qualifications, as they were called, and they introduce the new imaginatively titled National 4 and National 5. And these are, I think kids are currently studying for the first tranche of these exams in the summer. And the teacher associations, or some of them, the EIS in particular, are saying that huge pressure on teachers. We need to take the pressure off, introducing new qualifications, new exams when we're not ready for them. There hasn't been enough exemplification, I see quite a number of teachers on Twitter complaining about this. You know, the SQA haven't provided enough exemplification. We're not entirely sure what we're doing. Kids are not entirely sure what they're doing. At the same time, there's a letter in the Herald, Glasgow Herald as was, last week, a couple of weeks ago, from a fourth-year pupil. I am a fourth-year pupil in a state secondary school. I'm writing to express my anger and utter exasperation with the new Curriculum for Excellence, the SQA, and in particular the new National Qualifications. So basically the whole system, really. But her concern with the new qualifications is that they are not nearly as challenging or as rigorous as the previous
grades.
So, having completed my N5 prelims last week, I was shocked and saddened at how easy these were when compared to credit intermediate 2 past papers I've done. So that's an interesting criticism of a different kind, if you like. But what strikes me in all of that is the question of whether it's actually possible to introduce national qualifications which reflect the aims of Curriculum for Excellence. Now, if the aims of Curriculum for Excellence are, as we say they are, to develop these 4 capacities in young people, to what extent will the new qualifications reflect that? And my take on that is that they couldn't possibly reflect the development of the 4 capacities.
And I guess in a world which is becoming increasingly dominated by the kind of global human capital arguments and you know, the economic imperatives of things like PISA, then presumably your national qualifications are become the big story in town, don't they?
Yeah, that's right. And the results of the new national qualifications will go into that mixer, be chopped up and analysed, and that's essentially where we will stand in world terms, if you like.
That's unless we
really take the bull by the horns in Scotland and say, well, we don't really care what PISA say because they're not measuring what we're trying to do.
I mean, what it suggests is in these kind of national stories is the total lack of alignment between curriculum and pedagogy and assessment.
I think so. I think that tension. I mean, I think I'm a Scotland supporter, so I'm going to say I think we're largely doing the right thing. And what we're engaging in at the moment is we're engaging in a tension which is almost inevitable, and which the rest of the world will meet at some point if it hasn't met it already.
I think even, you know, in Finland are sort of looking at their, you know, having to have a rethink and saying, okay, yeah, we've had the world visiting us for a while, but actually, you know, this is a constant process of renewal, isn't it? I mean, it's a long-term process of learning. And I guess, you know, at the most abstract level, you need to have leaders and teachers who are really empowered to do that groundwork, visioning groundwork, where it matters in the schools. But you also need that critical challenge to come in from outside, and a challenge which is about the vision of the curriculum rather than about performance
to
PISA.
I mean, in practical terms, Steve, it may well be we're at the point now where, I mean, these 4 capacities and the statements underneath them were developed, you know, we're getting on for a decade now. So we may actually be at the point where we need to revisit them.
Yeah.
I just refresh people's memories and stimulate that debate again. And teachers will be knocking their heads on the table saying, oh, God,
again.
More debate, more discussion, more changes, more.
But presumably you've got a new generation of teachers coming out of the universities and training colleges, which are presumably just being steeped in Curriculum for Excellence, I'm assuming.
I guess so. Interestingly enough, I was in a primary school in Aberdeenshire yesterday, and there were two schools that had come together, and I was spending a day with them looking at looking at literacy issues and you know what we mean by literacy now in digital literacy and so on. But it was quite marked actually how young they were on the whole. I mean, there were still more experienced teachers there as well, but when I looked at the average age of the young teachers in the room, I thought, good grief, it is a new generation, certainly. I wasn't having that kind of discussion with them, but I wish I was, in a sense. It would be interesting to have it. I don't know what their perceptions are of curriculum models, or as you say, learning models.
Because I remember having conversations with teachers in England who'd kind of, there was the pre-national kind of 88 Reform Act teachers and the post who, you know, and the teachers who'd been through, who'd come out of the new Labour literacy and numeracy strategies, who, and there were definite kind of shifts in perceptions of those teachers, you know, and then the ones who'd kind of trained under the very kind of directive strategies, centrally imposed strategies, when we talked to them about teaching, said, oh, I didn't know I could do that. You know, I didn't know I had the freedom to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the kind of the pre, you know, the old hands, if you like, saying, oh, God, you know, this is becoming more regulated and it's more. So there definitely are generational shifts in teachers and how they've been trained. But they'd be an interesting one to follow up. Bill, I'm very aware of the time. I mean, any kind of final thoughts on this story? I think what we've got here is a really fascinating story about a really substantial change process, national change process, and it's the tensions between its local and national system context. So I think it's a really fascinating one for us to learn from. So any final thoughts on where it needs to go?
Well, a couple of final thoughts. One is that we are engaging in debate about the curriculum on a regular basis here, which in a sense can only be good. It's painful. I think it's painful and I think it's messy. I just wonder whether at the time of development, I just wonder whether in actual fact it should have been even messier.
Right.
And we may have avoided some of the pain now. But I think decisions were taken at the time to make it a bit less messy. And by that, when I say that, I mean to stick with the, in a sense, the development of outcomes within subject areas rather than going in the other direction, which I described. Or I think it would have been even messier. But I think, you know, I don't think there's any change without pain.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
But I definitely think we're going in the right direction. I think there's very little disagreement about the general principles of curriculum for excellence. So if we've reached that point, we have reached a very significant point.
Yeah. Well, that's a very heartening place to, and as I say, the dialogue has got to be good. certainly, we look north of the border with some envy,
well,
given the total lack of dialogue down
let's
here.
Let's get into speaking about the English curriculum now for the next 10 seconds. We'll cover it in 10 seconds. Huge issues, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Bill, it's been a really enjoyable conversation, and hopefully you'll send our regular listeners off to sleep in...
I'll probably send them off to sleep.
In good cheer.
Always a pleasure.
Yes, so good night then.
Cheers, good night.